That was Kristen Lems from her In the Outdoor, Days of the Theocracy. Good stuff. Well, the latest thing I got on the net about Berkeley, and I am interested in the Berkeley situation since it is so imminent, so immediate, this first reading of the sitting ordinance, which is the crucial reading, will be happening in 2 days, Tuesday evening at 7 at Berkeley City Council. Here's an article from the Contra Costa Times by Chuck Squattagriglia, and it's Berkeley may ban sidewalk lounging. A city council progressive may tip the scale in favor of a, quote, moderate ordinance to prohibit sitting or lying in commercial areas. Sitting on the sidewalk soon will be a crime if some of the city council have their way. The council is expected to approve Tuesday an ordinance making it illegal to sit or lie on sidewalks in commercial districts. The council repealed a similar law just 15 months ago. The law, proposed by Mayor Shirley Dean, applies to the entire city, but is clearly aimed at Telegraph Avenue, where merchants and residents have long complained of homeless young adults blocking sidewalks. The city is trying to clean up Telegraph and rein in its anything-goes attitude, and the ordinance is the latest and perhaps most controversial means of doing that. Here's an aside from this article. There's already a law against blocking sidewalks, so it has nothing to do with blocking sidewalks. It has to do with removing certain kinds of people from the area, particularly from the vicinity of the businesses. The ordinance is fairly straightforward. With few exceptions, sitting or lying on a public sidewalk in a commercial district would be illegal between 8 a.m. and midnight. Violators will be asked to move on. Those who refuse will be ticketed. Most people following the politically charged debate over Telegraph saw the ordinance coming. What has created a stir is the fact that Councilwoman Margaret Breland has broken ranks with her progressive colleagues to join the mayor in endorsing the measure. Berkeley politics is divided into two factions, the moderates, led by Dean, and the progressives, who are led by Vice Mayor Madel Sharik and hold a 5-4 advantage on the council. The two sides are like oil and water, and when they mix, it tends to get messy. Breland, who voted to repeal a similar law last year, could not be reached for comment. Her decision makes the measure almost certain to pass because the moderates wholeheartedly support it. It also places her squarely on the hot seat as progressives encourage her to reconsider. I think this is going to be the worst 4 or 5 days she'll have on the council, said Don Jelinek, a progressive stalwart, Breland ally and mayoral candidate. The proposal is adding to the controversy about how to improve Telegraph Avenue. Proponents say the measure is needed to bring order to the street where homeless young adults often line the sidewalk with their dogs and packs, making passage difficult. And I haven't observed that myself. A lot of people there, but it's not that passage is difficult unless you insist that there be no people within a 5-foot range of you as you walk along. But critics call the measure mean-spirited and unnecessary, arguing there are laws on the books to deal with all of Telegraph's ills. The city has been down this path before. In 1994, the council reacted to public demand to curtail aggressive panhandling by adopting two ordinances that made it illegal to sit or lie within 6 feet of a business. The American Civil Liberties Union immediately sued. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals tossed out much of the law, but upheld the no-sitting ordinance in December 1996. But the progressives had more control over the council by that time and voted to repeal the law in April 1997. Jim Shannon, the ACLU attorney who led the fight against the 1994 law, could not say what action the ACLU might take if the council adopts the ordinance. Although the proposed ordinance is tougher than the law passed in 1994, it makes the entire sidewalk off limits. Fighting it in court will be tough because the appeals court upheld a similar ordinance in Seattle. That's the Contra Costa Times story about the Berkeley anti-sitting law. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And the call-in number here, in case you want to join this discussion, should it be illegal to sit down on the sidewalk? Should we care here in Santa Cruz what goes on in Berkeley? Is 423-5361. 423-5361. So do call in, join us, let us know what your thoughts are on the subject. Join the debate and discussion. Let's hear what you have to say. But hearing no phone calls, what I will do is turn to another interview. This one, an interesting interview from San Francisco and the Coalition on Homelessness, where Mara Rader, who writes for Street Sheet and has also been a cop watcher on the streets, she was watching when I got a ticket for being in the park after 10 o'clock at night. No, it wasn't Jim Lang of Santa Cruz ticketing me, although he single-handedly had the parks of Santa Cruz closed, actually with the help of the city council, but it was his initiative, as well as closing the riverbank along the San Lorenzo River. After dark, if you attempt to walk up and down the river with your schnookums, you'll both get tickets, maybe matching tickets. If you do it twice, you may go to jail for up to 6 months. It's a misdemeanor. Thank you, Jim Lang. In any case, Mara Rader of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco has been helping poor people in San Francisco to fight these bogus tickets, and here she is talking about what's going on up there. Okay, well, on the line with the Coalition on Homelessness activist Mara Rader. Hi, Mara.
Hello.
How's life at the Coalition?
Pretty good.
Excellent.
Whatever.
Yeah, right. I guess that one of the last times I ran into you was when you were busy documenting the harassment efforts around Golden Gate Park and the fall campaign to drive the homeless out of the park. Do you remember that? Hello?
Hi. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. This speakerphone sometimes doesn't speak as much as it should. What's been happening around Golden Gate Park? Any updates?
There's been... Some stuff going on there, mostly with the neighborhood groups.
Mm-hmm.
There's been,
I know there was a group called, Somebody's Against Drugs?
They say Residents Against Druggies.
Yeah.
Actually, there's someone who has much more up-to-date information than I do, that's right here.
Oh, really?
Would you want to talk to him?
If you think so, although we're also interested in the issue of the lawsuit, which would he also know about that?
No, but I can tell you pretty quickly that we had 12 people continued on with the process in suing the city.
For what, small claims court seizure of their property?
Exactly.
Uh-huh, and how are they doing on that lawsuit?
There's no larger lawsuit, there's just individual small claims.
And is that, do you think, having an impact on the police department, or is that not noticeable, or what's your assessment?
It's still a little bit too early because we just filed the small claims last week.
Uh-huh.
And so we're kind of waiting to see what the impact is at this point. Mm-hmm. But people are ready to go to court, you know, in a month. So we'll see what happens with their individual cases.
I also understand that around Hot Cookie, where there's a program to kind of stop panhandling in the Castro, you and Food Not Bombs and other groups have been getting together to try to bring public attention to this anti-homeless effort. Is that true?
Yeah, we've been working in the Castro for a while with a group that that has been actually a very cool group that's been saying that they want to get together with homeless residents of the Castro to talk about what some of the problems are and what kind of solutions they can come up with that don't include calling in the police and that don't include just trying to kick people out of their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been working on that, and sort of the latter parts of our effort, the merchants group in the Castro, the Muncie group, got a new president who is very against having poor people in the Castro. And so he started, or the merchants of Upper Market and Castro started an anti-panhandling campaign where they put signs out in their windows that discourage people from giving money to panhandlers and instead give money to, they identified these three organizations that that don't provide services in the Castro at all, and one of them doesn't even provide services to homeless people, which is basically sending the message that they don't really care what happens to homeless and poor people in the area. They just want them out of the Castro.
Are they having much impact, in your view?
The merchants?
Yes, this campaign. What's it called? Did they have a name for this campaign? Give a hand, not a hand up, not a handout, or some such thing?
No, it's part of a campaign called the Community Pride and Revitalization campaign. But, I mean, it's basically just a mean-spirited attempt to drive homeless people out of the area because they feel like, you know, they want the Castro's getting wealthier and wealthier, and they just don't want to have to deal with the fact that there are poor people in this country, this world, and in the Castro. And instead of trying to help people, they just want to keep them out of that area, so people are forced to move from place to place.
How are they affecting street cheap vendors, who I imagine are also in the Castro, right?
You know, I mean, it talks specifically about panhandlers, and the merchants always try and differentiate between panhandlers and homeless people, and how, of course, they have compassion for homeless people, but not for these, you know, nasty panhandlers. But in my opinion, you know, people are out there, and they panhandle because they're poor. That's why people panhandle. It's, you know, not to scam the system. It's not to, you know, whatever. They're not making
enough
so that they can survive through the day.
Uh-huh.
They're trying to get money to deal with getting toothpaste and getting shelter for the night. And, I mean, there's a number of things that people use their money on, but the reality is that their services just don't exist in San Francisco or any place else where you can get really your day-to-day necessities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what for the most part, that's what panhandlers do with their money is get that day-to-day services they need that social service agencies don't get to them.
Are they able to oppose panhandlers in this, what you would call, mean-spirited campaign in conjunction with social service providers? Are social service providers remaining neutral, or are they, along with the Coalition on Homelessness, hostile to this attempt to stigmatize poor people and panhandlers? You follow me?
Yeah, but it's a pretty general question, so...
In other words, there are social service agencies putting those little signs in their windows, too.
There are three agencies that are mentioned on the sign campaign, and they are, for the most part, supportive of the campaign. They're the agencies that tend to be more about securing their funding sources than actually providing real services to people.
Who are these agencies?
They have under Youth Services, they have Larkin Street. Under Substance Abuse and Mental Health, they have New Leaf. And under Shelter and Food, they have Dolores Street Community Services.
Mm-hmm. What about the counter-protests against this by Food Not Bombs and the Coalition? I understand you were up there with signs in front of this Hot Cookie store, which apparently is one of the main pushers of this program.
The owner of Hot Cookie, Dan Glazer, is the one who thought of the idea of the whole sign campaign, and then it was implemented through Muncie, through money from Muncie, and so we've kind of brought them out as a target to say that it's not okay for Castro merchants to have this up in their window, and there is an alternative, and this isn't going to solve anything. It's just going to more divide the neighborhood than really get together and actually come up with real solutions.
What is the alternative, Mari?
Well, again, I go back to that other group that's been meeting in the Castro, where they're really saying that there are problems that exist. We're not denying that, but instead of, you know, just calling in the police and not dealing with the real problems, they're trying to come up together as a community, or we've been part of that, trying to come up with real solutions that are going to help people. I mean, they range in, you know, intensity or seriousness from, not seriousness, but I mean, the issue is, like, an issue will be identified that a lot of people are urinating in public. Mm-hmm. And so this group, instead of saying, have the police come out and give people tickets, this group is saying, let's find 24-hour public bathrooms in the Castro.
Wasn't there a big to-do about these famous French self-cleaning or self-flushing bathrooms that they put up everywhere at huge expense?
Right, and there is one in the Castro, and that's actually the first thing that this group did was the French toilet that they had in the Castro used to close at 10 p.m., which doesn't make any sense. And so we got it so that it was open 24 hours a day now.
And is that resulting in a huge increase in vandalism and problems, or is that working out?
No, it's definitely helping. The downside is it's only one,
mm-hmm.
And there's definitely more needed. There also, there's it's sometimes hard to get tokens, which make it free, and so otherwise it's 25 cents.
Mm-hmm.
But the other problem is they break down a lot. So, I mean, it's definitely not the end all, but it's moving in the right direction.
How many of them are there throughout the city, you know?
I have no idea.
Also, has this, has the anti-panhandling campaign had much of an impact in driving poor people out of the Castro, or has it been ineffective?
I would say that the impacts that I have seen have more resulted from the police coming in and messing with people.
Are the police acting in conjunction with the program, or is it sort of independent?
My understanding is that the merchants also met with a captain of Mission Station to encourage, you know, their officers to take a more active role in kicking homeless and poor people out of that area. And that seems to have an impact, have had an impact. Also, there has been, it's certainly, like anything, when you see someone who has, if people think it's an unpopular position to take to, excuse me, people are feeling more able to express their displeasure of poor and homeless people in the Castro now that these signs are out there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting a lot more really ignorant comments from people that think it's okay to just yell out, get a job, or, just
kind of
pretty obnoxious, ignorant comments.
Right. I know that the Coalition on Homelessness has documented as long ago as a year back that the anti-homeless enforcement of sleeping codes that make it illegal for homeless people to sleep even though there are no legal places for them to sleep had more than doubled under the new mayor, supposedly liberal Willie Brown, compared with the conservative police chief, former police chief Frank Jordan. Is that statistic continuing? Are the police continuing essentially the Matrix program under another name?
It does seem, yes. I mean, we have seen that a lot of numbers have gone up,
mm-hmm.
since, including when Brown has been in office. Sorry, I kind of missed some of your question because people were talking to me.
Sure. Now, the question again was, you know, sleeping arrests and arrests for so-called quality of life crimes, which was a big deal under Jordan, apparently is an even bigger deal under Brown. You documented that about a year ago with showing that there was a doubling of such arrests or tickets. Is that unfortunate statistic still continuing?
It's hard to tell right now because, you know, we get statistics every month,
mm-hmm.
From the municipal court, and typically the numbers are lower in this part of the year than they start to, like, kind of go out of control during the summer months.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still kind of trying to see what trend it's taking right now, but it does seem that ever since they opened this huge shelter,
mm-hmm.
the China Basin area, that some of the numbers have decreased slightly.
Now, regarding the China Basin, we were hopeful that the Vehicular Residents Association group that your coalition had been backing for seeking negotiations with the city and actually engaging in negotiations with the city to set up some kind of vehicular park or safe parking zone for people living in their vehicles would yield some fruit. How is that going?
It's going great. We are getting pretty close to having this thing actually open.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there yet, but it's definitely going along.
Have police stopped seizing vehicles and vans, which they apparently were doing in the seeming contradiction to what the mayor's office was saying it was interested in doing, which is legalizing the right of people to sleep in their vehicles somewhere?
No.
So, you mean police have stopped seizing, or they're continuing to seize?
Continue to and seize people's property.
Wow. And is there much of a response from the vehicular community? Are they able to help each other out with that, or are they simply looking for deeper places to hide?
It depends on the individual, a little bit of everything, but, just a little bit of everything. People are really, you know, hoping that this thing will come through soon so that they'll have a place where they won't have to constantly be moving and in constant fear that their home is going to be towed by the police.
What are the... I know we also had a program supposedly by Amos Brown to look for free shopping carts or to get the police off the back of people who have to use shopping carts to keep their goods and possessions and bedding in. Whatever happened to that out of the Board of Supervisors, you know?
They just recently passed a resolution to start a committee that's focusing on questions of abandoned shopping carts.
What about the police?
They haven't had their first meeting yet.
Are the police still seizing shopping carts?
Yes. I mean, not, we haven't been getting as many reports of that lately,
mm-hmm.
but we've gotten some.
And I guess now to return to the original question, which you may want to put me on to someone else for, in Berkeley and San Jose, an anti-homeless media campaign claiming that the poor were kind of dirtying up the streets and they're drug pushers and, you know, they're junkies and they're bums and alcoholics littering Telegraph Avenue and St. James Park in San Jose seems to be matched by a similar campaign in The Hague, where there's a sort of a media attack on homeless people. We saw this kind of media attack in this Golden Gate Park, followed by massive sweeps and talks about infrared searching through helicopters for homeless camps. Do you or does anyone in the coalition have any information on what's going on in Haight Street?
Yeah, and the guy that I was going to have you talk to had to go get some dinner before they closed.
Uh-oh. Any kind of summary you can give us that you might know about?
But he said that he would talk to you at another time if he wanted.
Sure, we can do that, but for the moment, do you have any kind of quick overview of that, or? You can say no if you don't. I mean, that's a legitimate answer, of course.
No, I mean, it is similar stuff. The hate is a, you know, pretty good example of like, both sides. I can't explain it, but There's a lot of people up there who they consider themselves very liberal and really, you know, want to do something around homelessness in the hate and honestly want to do something that's respectful and is really going to meet people's needs.
Mm-hmm.
And they still believe that. And there's some people who have kind of moved on from that to, but I see, you know, human feces on my sidewalk every day and it's just getting to be too much and... like, I don't know what to do at this point anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the residents against druggies that just want to, you know...
call in the Gestapo.
Exactly, and put all the homeless people on an island and, you know, whatever. So, it's really pretty interesting the way it's playing out. A lot of people are trying to get a lot of different things done, and there's just a lot of conflict.
Is the media campaign cranking up against people in the hate, or was that just a one-time story by Ken Garcia?
Are you referring to the one in November or the recent one?
I'm referring to a recent one. Actually, I haven't seen a recent story by Garcia. I'm told there was such a story. He's, of course, a San Francisco Chronicle columnist. Was there such a story? I know there was an article in the Chronicle, I believe, attacking the homeless and the hate. I saw that one article. Has that been followed by others that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it was that one article.
Okay, well then I don't want to unfairly malign Kim, who's actually written some good things about other cities, though not so much about San Francisco. He wrote a good article about San Rafael and exposed the anti-homeless attacks on the soup kitchen up there. Anything that we should know about, I guess, and what about in your district in the Tenderloin? Do you think that the presence of the Coalition on Homelessness has a moderating effect on police conduct and pressure from other downtown groups to clear away homeless people and remove their civil rights?
I wouldn't necessarily say that just because we're in the Tenderloin that we have any more or less impact than in any other place in the city.
Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily see that you are a sanctuary or an island of peace and calm, nothing of that sort. Huh?
No, I wouldn't say that. But I would say that police definitely know about us and don't really like us very much.
Uh-huh. Well, you can't make friends with everybody, I guess. Tonight, as you may or may not know, is Don't Sleep Tonight night in Santa Cruz and other places.
Or it was Don't Sleep Tonight night. That was back on June 29th. That dates that interview. And there'll be another Don't Sleep Tonight night coming up on July 31st, listeners. That's when you'll be encouraged to stay awake and to toss off your blankets in solidarity with homeless people who have to do that if they are to remain legal after 11 o'clock at night outside. You're listening to Amaro Rader, Coalition on Homelessness activist in San Francisco, giving you the update in San Francisco. We turn now to Seattle, where I'm going to read a recent story about a tent city up there raised by Seattle homeless activists in solidarity with the homeless after police cleared away a traditional campground in the so-called jungle area up there. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, the police apparently are now threatening to come and remove the tent city. They're due by Monday or thereabouts, according to activist Anitra Freeman, who we're going to hear from in a brief interview which I recorded night before last. This is called Bulldozer Days, Can Seattle Stop Chasing Poor People Away? In the homeless newspaper Real Change, which comes out of Seattle. Photos and story by Sinian Demerol. A little light on the subject here. 4 years ago, police in the Seattle Conservation Corps completely demolished encampments on the west side of Beacon Hill, where more than 100 homeless men, women, and families have been living, some in tents and some in makeshift homes they'd constructed and lived in for years. Since that time, the jungle has never returned to what it had been. Annually, the city repeats the purge, albeit on a smaller scale, and the process of resettlement begins anew. Some things never change. After receiving word that a new sweep of the jungle was imminent, I started making periodic visits to warn folks of what was coming. Over the past month, I've spoken to several groups of people camping there, mostly in tents. When I escorted a journalist and member of Food Not Bombs on one of my trips to the camps, campers said, "Here's that reporter again and the missionary." I guess I'm the missionary. When I visit with folks, I ask if they've heard about the sweep, if they want to do something about it. Some people are willing to make a stand when the bulldozers come. I tell them some people are working on setting up a place where they can pitch their camps and not have to move over and over again. Most of the people at the jungle work, and many are mistrustful of the shelters and missions. One man I met was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Most say they'll be gone within a couple of weeks anyway. They're just saving up to rent a place. Drugs and predators in some downtown shelters create an atmosphere that jungle campers just don't want to go back to. Ed and Crystal have been living in the jungle in a tent for several weeks. They do their best to keep their area clean and have developed an elaborate system for carrying human waste away from their campsite. Crystal broke her leg on the muddy paths one night, and it took hours for them to slog down to the road in the industrial area to get help. Their campsite is close to two others. Folks stick close together for companionship and protection. They speak of how they watch out for each other and express a real pride of family when describing their companions. Ed tells us how their friend Don, living in the adjacent tent, gets up at 1 a.m. every day to get ready for work on Harbor Island. They share food, supplies, stories. The jungle is a self-policing community. In the largest camp I encountered, I was told in no uncertain terms that when crackheads showed up, they get chased off, told they shouldn't come back. I told them they had to leave now. We don't want any of that stuff around here. I won't put up with it, said James, who's in a camp with his girlfriend Arlene, her brother Duane, and a fellow named Will, who delivers the morning paper to city staffers at the municipal building. James and Duane want to pack their own garbage out. Do you know people at the city, they asked? Tell them. See if they put a dumpster up in the park. Me and him will haul all this stuff up on our backs. We'll do it. A few days later, they were able to obtain some garbage bags and have done what they can. Before, we called it homelessness. There were hobos and itinerant workers. When the numbers swelled during the Great Depression, many of them settled in Hoovervilles around the country. Hooverville originated in Seattle in 1931 and, after being burned out several times, finally located not too far from what is now the jungle. It was born of poverty and the failure of society to respond to massive unemployment, according to Alice Quintance, who researched Hooverville for Real Change. Over 10 years, 11,000 to 14,000 different people lived in Seattle's Hooverville, as many as 1,000 at a time. Seattle's Hooverville is an example of successful self-governance. Residents elected their own integrated governing committee and negotiated with city officials for sanitation and safety measures. The people who lived there considered living in their own shacks preferable to the conditions in the missions and the stigma of charity. For all its shortcomings, Hooverville proved the power of homeless people to manage their own affairs with some vacant land and minimal support through 10 years of hard times, says Quintance. And there are more recent examples of organized outdoor self-management. SHARE, Seattle Housing and Resource Effort, set up a tent city on the mud flats south of the King Dome the day before Thanksgiving in 1990. Eventually, the camp grew to 18 tents and more than 100 people. It lasted several weeks until the city responded by offering space for indoor shelter in the old Metro bus barn. SHARE has done other outdoor shelters, most notably during its Safe Haven campaign in 1995. For 7 months, self-management worked at this 50-mat co-ed shelter, variously located at 2nd and Yesler, the King Dome parking lot, and finally the King County Administration Building Plaza. We're not facing a Great Depression here, but we're failing. There are about 2,500 shelter beds available in Seattle, and by most estimates, 4,500 homeless people on any given night. Operation Nightwatch and its annual street count one night last fall counted more than 600 people sleeping on the streets downtown. In its annual purge of the jungle, government seems to be making willy-nilly decisions for people's lives without knowing what it's like for them. They're chasing people from place to place and deeper into unsafe and sanitary or solitary conditions. The simple answer is providing the means to clean up on an ongoing basis. There is so much space between the relatively few camps remaining in the jungle that it makes me wonder whether there could be the threat to public sanitation that city officials are leading us to believe. I wonder if any city officials have been there to see for themselves. There certainly isn't such a sanitation problem to justify a sweep in light of the serious lack of shelter and housing and the extreme violence on the streets. Other cities have responded in more humane ways to the need for people to have a safe place to stay while waiting for housing or shelter. Fort Lauderdale, Santa Cruz, Phoenix, and San Diego have experimented with organized encampments. San Francisco is in the process of looking into developing a car camp on one of its piers. The deputy mayor there has been assigned this thankless task. Mayor Schell of Seattle commented at a recent meeting that unused cargo containers might be suitable for outdoor shelter. His aides are looking into it. The people I talked to think this might work, and they definitely want a safe outdoor spot where they can continue to camp together. What's needed could be provided for much less money than what the city spends chasing people away, and the great chase doesn't solve anything. A man I saw several times in the jungle, whom I began to call the prophet, said, "You young people are the hope for the future. Tell them to go to their homes." We all need to go to our homes. And that's an article in the June issue, or is it the July issue? No, it's the June issue of Real Change, the Seattle homeless newspaper. So apparently what happened was, in response to this police sweep, SHARE and other organizations in Seattle and homeless people set up a tent city right in front of the City Hall area downtown, or in one of the major parks downtown. And they were told to move, and they agreed to move, and they moved back to the jungle and set up tents there. And now they've been told they have to leave that property or be arrested for trespass. Let's hear what Anitra Freeman of Real Change, who is putting out alerts on the internet about the upcoming confrontation and the struggle for housing and just the right to be in public spaces for poor and homeless people in Seattle, what she has to say. That was Anitra Freeman of Seattle a night before last talking on the phone about the plans of Seattle homeless to resist harassment, ticketing, and arrest by police for simply trying to survive outside where there is no legal place for them to be in Seattle. We're going to follow that story more closely, and on Thursday hopefully we'll have more information for you when our show returns at 6 o'clock Thursday night here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. 96.3 FM. Seattle, of course, isn't the only place where homeless people are demonstrating for basic civil rights. Another place, as you know, if you've been listening to the show, is San Diego, where for now going into its fourth month, 3.5 months now, San Diego homeless have been out in front of the City Hall Concourse, which is sort of a combination City Hall shopping center area. Ritzy, glitzy, upscale downtown San Diego, sleeping every night 150 to 200 strong. We had a brief interview with Ann Curo, who writes for the street newspaper in San Diego, Streetlight, talking about how San Diego responded to Do Not Sleep Tonight Night, Don't Sleep Tonight Night, Insomnia Night, Sleeplessness Night, Our Santa Cruz Night, where we ask people throughout the country to give up a night of sleep, give up covering up with blankets, to be in solidarity with the Santa Cruz homeless. Let's hear what Ann has to say.
Okay, we're on the line with Streetlight editor, writer, and homeless activist Ann Curo. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
And Ann, you got some updates for us on the protests after Don't Sleep Tonight night. And
that's right.
I guess you in San Diego, you guys stayed up all night, some of you, in honor of the Santa Cruz homeless who are forced to do that if they are to obey the law. Of course, most of them don't, but they risk $162 tickets. So what happened? You said there was some unusual action by some actors.
Okay, well, some of the homeless people at our protest made friends with some of the cast of Grease, which is showing in the building right next to them. And they've been banned from associating with anybody, any of the audience or cast members, but they crossed the barrier and went over and talked to Charo, who's the star of Grease, and also the other guy whose name I don't remember. But
this is Grease, the musical from the 70s that kind of replicates the 50s, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's about aspiring actors and things like that. So I haven't seen it, but I've heard about it. And Charo was very sympathetic, and the cast and crew ordered many boxes of pizzas for some of the protesters down there. And then this morning, we have word that she appeared at the city council meeting and told the mayor, she signed up for public comment, told the mayor, "I don't understand why you're treating these nice people that way," referring to the people downstairs at the...
What was the mayor's witty response?
Oh, I wasn't there. And Forrest has just gone to go and get a tape of the city council meeting, so we can hear the actual quote.
And you have, I guess, not just, you also have an interest by other media in the protest, which, as I was telling activist Roger Scott earlier today, is the longest protest of its size that I have ever heard of on the West Coast.
It's growing.
And apparently
growing. So we've got close to 250 people in the staying right around the city concourse area.
Mm-hmm. Well, pretty soon you'll have to start farming out the area, tearing up the sidewalk, you know, planting vegetables.
Divided up into four neighborhoods, just for ease of governing it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Are you kidding?
We've got, there's the Emerald City, and there's the Hood, and they keep changing the names of the different neighborhoods.
Uh-huh.
And then they have their own meetings, and their own committees and so forth.
Wow, you know, I was there 2 weeks ago sleeping out, and it was really the most peaceful, pleasant experience you can imagine. I left early because the car parking situation is, I think from 3 to 5 they tow you away or something.
Uh-huh.
But it was quite comfortable, more so than our frosty, inhospitable protests up here in Santa Cruz, where you never know if the cops are going to show up and give you a ticket. I guess in San Diego, the cops have kept hands off this protest largely, right?
We're encouraging them to come only if someone is posing an actual physical threat to someone else. The protesters, the leaders of the protest, the ones that take the most responsibility, will get together and try to defuse any kind of situation that arises, and they're pretty successful at that.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't had to call the police lately.
That's really wonderful.
So we've been learning all kinds of different techniques.
Huh. I know that you are also working with Urban Safari of Larry Milligan's group, the guy who feeds people in Balboa Park, is that right?
Yeah, in fact, Larry is down there tonight for the documentary, which is going to cover homeless activism in San Diego. The KPBS radio people have been following him around all day as he rehashes what's happened in the last 6 or 7 years since he's been an activist.
Yeah, he's been doing a lot of that. I know I've got an old San Diego file that goes way back.
And they're planning to spend the night at the concourse tonight and document the protest on a normal night.
Uh-huh.
We invited them to come last night, but they said they wanted to be there on a normal night when people actually sleep.
Well, wasn't last night a special night where not only did people, some of them, not sleep in honor of the Santa Cruz homeless, but they also marched into a commercial area that the police told them to stay out of?
That was a couple of nights ago, I think Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
That was then, and they were handing out leaflets about the stay up all night in solidarity with Santa Cruz.
Did the newspapers pick up on this at all?
Not the daily paper.
Mm-hmm.
Daily paper's kind of spotty about covering us.
Right, spotty, and I would say probably pretty established.
Well, we're working on getting out a new edition of Streetlight, although we're somewhat behind in working on that.
You'd better get busy.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're trying to keep up to the minute with the news, and things keep happening.
Yeah, Streetlight, of course, is the monthly publication you put out.
Yeah, that's our homeless advocacy newspaper.
And it also is sold by homeless people for
homeless vendors on the street.
That's wonderful. Anything else you want to add?
No, I'm tired.
And I'd be tired too if I were here in that situation. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Looks like I'm tired even in the middle of the day, but I'm not giving up yet. We have another 40-50 minutes of the show, and we go till 1:30. If you want to call in to comment on any of this stuff, if you've had some experiences locally about being in a public space as a homeless person or seeing people treated one way or another, how do you feel about this issue? Give us a call at 423-5361 if you want to talk about it on the show. Last night or the night before, I was on the streets. Actually, it was Friday night, July 3rd, the evening right before the 4th of July, and I passed some fundamentalist preachers near the New Life Market. One fellow was playing guitar, another one was singing, a woman was giving away little brochures. Fundamentalism isn't my thing particularly, but apparently it was theirs. But when I started back up there later, I heard loud shouts. It turned out that a merchant, Ali Baba of Ali Baba's Cafe, was filing a complaint against the preacher for preaching, and I got some of that on tape. You'll find it instrumental and interesting, or informative anyway, to hear this kind of discussion that went on. It turned into a discussion with the police, and Officer Brandt, with his German Shepherd watchdog, Officer Brandt is the officer with the English accent who walks around downtown Pacific Avenue with this German Shepherd dog on a leash, and usually gets a response from me, what is a German Shepherd dog doing in 1998 Santa Cruz on a crowded street? What are we doing with an attack dog, a German Shepherd attack dog in downtown Santa Cruz? I mean, are we dealing with terrorists? Is there some sort of national crisis? I don't know. But anyway, you'll get to hear this in just a moment.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, hi.